Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
Happy Tuesday. It's Tuesday, November 11th, 2025, Veterans Day, and a big shout out to all of the amazing men and women serving our country currently, and of course, all those who sacrifice so much as veterans. We appreciate your service. God bless you all, and especially your families as well. On this day, we have a lot to talk about. There's news from Washington, the shutdown. They did vote to move forward and open up the government again. We'll have the details in the news. And we also had a very sad story that is posted on the Catholic News Agency website this morning. For those of us in the media, especially in the Catholic world, and of course, if you followed the story of the face of God in Montepello, if you've been to Abruzzo for that beautiful site there, you may be familiar with the great work of Paul Batty, a German journalist based in Rome for many, many years, a good friend of ours at EWTN and Catholic News Agency, passed away. He was only 77 years old. And just pray for his family, his beautiful wife, Ellen, and his children and grandchildren. I met Paul Batty through a mutual friend, Steve Ray, of course, also well known to our viewers and listeners at EWTN, many years ago, and Steve and I were doing a pilgrimage together, Saints and Shrines, and he brought Paul on because his book about the face of God and the veil in Montepello, again, which is in southern Italy in Abruzzo, was really starting to make news and to make headlines. And he gave a talk on the book and on the veil. And ever since then, we hit it off. And when I would go to Rome for the network, or, you know, if I was doing a pilgrimage, I'd make sure I had time to have lunch or dinner with Ellen and Paul. They were so, so nice and just wonderful people and love the Lord and love the church. And Paul was a really, I mean, just an amazing journalist. So we'll have a story about that in the news, but I'm just saying that to you so you can check out the story on CatholicNewsAgency.com and pray for his family. Also coming up today after the news and the weather, we have Frank DeVito, who's the Napa Legal Institute Senior Counsel and Director of Content. Now, this story came out a few weeks ago, but we've been trying to track Frank down because it's very important, and it gives us an idea of where we are across the country, where we stand with our state governments and how they treat religious nonprofits and religious organizations. And my home state of Michigan at rock bottom, but the good state of Alabama at the very top. So we'll discuss that with Frank. And then we're going to take a look at how that amazing conference of Lady, for the Conference of Lady down in Mexico City went. We did an interview last month, if you recall, with Bishop Olmsted, the retired Archbishop of Phoenix, or Bishop of Phoenix, Arizona, and Christopher Pereira, and he's going to be joining us as well, CEO of Tepeyac Leadership, to talk about how the conference went. It was entitled Hour of the Lady Conference, and they had amazing speakers. And so we'll get a follow-up with Christopher. So that is our show for today, and I do hope you can stay tuned for the entire 2 hours this morning, the first hour here on Catholic Connection, the second, of course, on our own EWTN Radio Extra channel. Let's see what's happening in the weather. We still have some frigid cold temps in the east and snow continuing in the Great Lakes area. A frigid cold air mass continuing to bring colder weather across the eastern two-thirds of the country. And it continues today. Record low temperatures expected to be tied or broken across the southeast and even in the state of Florida. Periods of snow will continue downward in the Great Lakes and in portions of the interior New England. And that's through this afternoon with several inches of snowfall accumulation expected. So I was talking to my friend Chuck Gatica from, of course, you know him from being a guest here on Catholic Connection and from media in the metro area. And he was telling me they had snow, about an inch of snow a few days ago, but it has since melted. But a lot of folks across the country, as you can hear from this weather forecast, are going to be experiencing the colder weather. It's a cold front that is moving through. It's 4 minutes past the hour. We have a lot of news to get through, including the breaking news on the shutdown, which will soon be ending. At least that's what they're saying. So let's see what's happening here on EWTN on Tuesday, November 11th, this Veterans Day. Well, as we just mentioned, the Senate voting last night to end the government shutdown.
On this vote, the ayes are 60, the nays are 40. The bill, as amended, is passed.
The chamber voting last night to pass a funding measure, which now goes on to the U.S. House. Republican Senator Susan Collins says passage of the bill is good news for federal workers.
We are going to reopen government. We're going to ensure that federal employees, whether they were furloughed or laid off or forced to work without pay will now receive compensation.
The measure would fund the government through January. It passed on a 60-40 vote. The House is not expected, though, to take up the bill until at least tomorrow at the earliest. President Trump, meanwhile, says the government will be opening quickly. He spoke to reporters at the White House, saying he approves of a deal struck between Republicans and a handful of Democrats.
The deal is very good. We're not going to be giving $1.5 trillion to people that came in from jails and from, the gangs and drug dealers and all of these others.
The agreement, again, must make it through the Senate, as we mentioned, before it goes to the House. This is on its way to the House and then to the president for his signature. President Trump also says he believes the minority leader, Chuck Schumer, in the Senate, went over the top in the fight for the shutdown.
Well, I think he made a mistake in going too far. He just went too far. He thought he could break the Republicans, and the Republicans broke him.
In an interview on Fox News, the president discussing a series of topics, also saying he was not pleased when he saw the air traffic controller staffing issues in recent days. In other news this morning, the families of six campers and two counselors killed in Texas floods, as Rory O'Neill tells us, are now filing major lawsuits 5 months after their deaths.
Two separate lawsuits were filed Monday, one by the family of camper Lulu Peck and the other by the families of five campers and two counselors who died in the 4th of July weekend tragedy. Both lawsuits accuse Camp Mystic, the Eastland family, and the camp's management companies of negligence and wrongful death. Each lawsuit seeks more than $1 million in damages. In all, 25 campers died along with the two counselors during that natural disaster. I'm Rory O'Neill.
The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday declining a request, Catholic News Agency explains this morning, to overturn so-called same-sex marriage. Kim Davis, a former county clerk from Kentucky, petitioning the Supreme Court in July to reconsider the 2015 ruling, which legalized civil marriages between people of the same sex nationally. Davis requested the court also hear her case 10 years later after she made headlines for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. She served several days in jail for contempt of court for violating a judicial order to issue the marriage licenses, and she was then also ordered to pay more than $360,000 in damages and legal fees for violating a same-sex couple's right to marry. After lower courts rejected her claim that the Constitution's First Amendment right to free exercise of religion protected her in the case, she then appealed to the Supreme Court. She also reported this morning the Trump administration did not weigh in on the case as the High Court considered whether to take up the matter. The Supreme Court made the decision to reject the request yesterday, but has made no comment on the matter. And as we mentioned at the top of the hour, Paul Batty, author of many well-known books such as Benedict Up Close, The Face of God, and The True Icon, passing away early yesterday morning at the age of 77 after a long illness. He was also a veteran contributor to EW Chan and Catholic News Agency's German language news partner. He was born in 1948 in Germany in a small village on the Rhine River, studying philosophy and sociology as well as art history and political science before embarking on a journalistic career. He also worked as a teacher for several years. As a journalist, he served for many years as a Jerusalem correspondent before moving to the city of Rome. He was also one of the founding editors of Vatican Magazine. He died in his beloved Montepello in the Italian Abruzzo region. Paul and his wife Ellen had five children. Pope Leo says AI use in healthcare must ensure quality of care and relationships. As Devin Watkins reports from Vatican News, the Pope sent a message to those taking part in a conference offering his prayerful good wishes for their deliberations about the use of artificial intelligence in healthcare.
In his message, the Pope noted the pervasive influence of AI and other technological advances on humanity. He said our interaction with AI heavily influences the way we think and alters how we perceive ourselves and others. We currently interact with machines as if they were interlocutors and thus become almost an extension of them, he said. We not only run the risk of losing sight of the faces of the people around us, but of forgetting how to recognize and cherish all that is truly human. Pope Leo highlighted the benefits technological developments have brought to the fields of medicine and health. However, he added, true progress requires that individuals and public entities uphold human dignity and the common good. Though AI and other technologies can be used to devastating effect on humanity when used maliciously, those same technologies have the potential to be transformative and beneficial if placed at the true service of the human person, said the Pope. He then focused on the irreplaceable nature of human relationships in providing care for individuals.
And the Pope also telling the medical professionals gathering for that conference at the Vatican, saying they must both have the expertise to offer care and the ability to communicate effectively while expressing closeness to their patients. Healthcare cannot be reduced, he said, to solving a problem, adding that technological devices must never take away again from the patient-care relationship. At least 18 people were hurt at Dulles International Airport in Virginia after a mobile lounge, also known as a people mover, struck a dock. The Metropolitan Washington Airport Authority saying the lounge was transporting passengers when it struck the dock at an angle. Authorities initially said just 8 people had been taken to the hospital, later raising that number to 18. The injuries, though, are not considered life-threatening. New York City is honoring those who have served our country on this Veterans Day. The annual Veterans Day Parade, marching up Fifth Avenue, starting at 25th Street at 12:30 today. This year's parade, marking the 250th anniversary of the start of the Revolutionary War. That's when the U.S. Army, Navy, and Marines were formed. The Veterans Day wreath-laying ceremony takes place at Madison Square Park at 11 a.m. Meanwhile, there will also be a ceremony at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum this afternoon at 3:30. Monica Nelson tells us, again, today is Veterans Day, and along with that comes an increased focus on the sensitive topic of suicide.
From the Department of Veterans Affairs noted an average of 17.6 suicides per day among veterans, a rate that's far higher than the general non-veteran population. If you are a veteran in crisis or know someone who is, the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline can be reached 24/7 by calling 988. I'm Monica Nelson.
And the president will be visiting Arlington National Cemetery today. The president expected to lay a wreath at the tomb, of course, of the unknown soldier, and then deliver remarks as part of an official observance ceremony. This year's Veterans Day proclamation from the White House notes, "The story of America is written with the courage, honor, and dedicated service of our veterans." Wikipedia wants AI companies to utilize their paid services. Their nonprofit parent company, Wikimedia Foundation, says AI companies have been scrapping their web pages. It says companies who pay for Wikimedia Enterprise can help ensure the nonprofit Wikipedia is not strained. And Wizard of Oz fans will soon have the chance to own one of the most iconic costume pieces from that famous movie. Margaret Hamilton's original Wicked Witch of the West black hat will go up for auction next month. It will be part of Heritage Auctions' December Hollywood Signatures event. The auction will also include Judy Garland's red rehearsal slipper and a cast-signed copy of L. Frank Baum's A Wonderful Wizard of Oz book. Other items that will be part of the auction include Elvis Presley's 1976 Harley Davidson, Marilyn Monroe's Cleopatra costume, and artwork from the film Star Wars. It is a Tuesday. It is Veterans Day. Thanks for tuning in to EWTN's Catholic Connection. We'll be right back. Stay tuned. Here at EWTN's Catholic Connection. It's a Tuesday, Veterans Day. God bless all of our veterans. November 11, 2025. Very important topic. How do our states treat religious organizations and nonprofits as well? Frank DeVito is the Napa Legal Institute Senior Counsel and Director of Content. And the Napa Legal Institute has come out with recently their annual Faith and Freedom Index. Frank, thanks for joining us today. You want to start with the good news for Alabama or the bad news for my home state of Michigan? What do you think?
We can go either way, but thank you so much for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Okay, let's start with the good news. State of Alabama doing very, very well in this category, right?
Yes. So there are a lot of reasons for that. So the Faith and Freedom Index is it's a unique study, first of all, in that we're focusing on, as you said, the laws that affect religious organizations. There are a lot of studies, but they tend to focus on religious exercise rights for individuals. So this is a little different. The other thing I've been told no one else really does is that we couple both the religious freedom kind of laws that you would expect, the things that make headlines, non-discrimination laws, mm-hmm. state of emergency laws, and so on, with regulatory laws, things that don't make the headlines so often, tax exemptions, charitable regulations, corporate governance laws. And so what you get is a pretty wide-ranging view of the kinds of laws that affect faith-based nonprofits and how the different states do on that. So Alabama is unique in that for a couple reasons. For one, it has a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is a really important baseline protection for religious mm-hmm. exercise across mm-hmm. the board. Maybe we'll get to that later. But it has it actually enshrined in its state constitution. I believe it's the only state in the union that does that. Non-discrimination laws are fairly narrow and don't tend to conflict with religious hiring or programming. And then its regulatory and tax regime is not perfect, but pretty good. And so the overall landscape in Alabama, it scores the highest on our scoring system. But again, no state is perfect, right? That's a 72%. So every state has room for improvement.
Especially my home state of Michigan. So why did Michigan fare so poorly?
Yeah, it's probably a similar conversation if I go down the line of the types of laws that one needs to have. So Michigan does not have a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which can be mm-hmm. a problem. One of the big ones, and we've been tracking this a lot because I think this is going to be an increasingly problematic tension between religious organizations and laws and government, is the non-discrimination laws. At least that's how they're commonly called. I quibble with that term. But you have these laws in place for public programming and for employment that you can't discriminate on the basis of, right, it started with the Civil Rights Act in the 60s, on the basis of race, ethnicity, ancestry, sex, and then we've added in more and more categories. So in particular, when you have laws at the state level that ban discrimination in hiring or programming on the basis of religion, you could see where there'd be a conflict, or sex, including sexual orientation and gender identity, you have a real problem. And Michigan has among the most difficult, problematic laws in the country for that. There are very expansive non-discrimination laws and no real meaningful exemptions or accommodations for religious organizations. There's a little qualifying clause where if you think that you have a reason to discriminate in good faith, then you can ask the state agency in Michigan for an exemption, and they can, you can guess how likely it is that they'll actually write back to you and grant you that.
Yeah. So how much of this has to do, and I'm sure it has a lot to do with the people in office. For example, you and I were talking during the break about how bad in terms of way leading to the left, both our governor and also our attorney general are. How much impact do the people in office have on this?
Yes, that's a great question. And it's something that I clarify a lot when I talk about the Faith and Freedom Index. So on one hand, there's a little bit of a political spectrum here. You can see that there are some heavily weighed, you know, there are more red states, quote unquote, at the top of the list and probably more blue states at the bottom of the list. But it's not exclusively. A lot of the time there are old laws on the books or things that have never been changed in states that might surprise you. There are some good laws in California. There are some terrible laws in West Virginia. So not all a partisan thing. But it can get more complicated than that. The political landscape is complex, but there are some even very friendly to religious liberty type of states, but they don't want to touch the budget. So you ask about improved tax exemptions, and no way, it's not on the table, no political appetite for it. And beyond that, I think, as you had said, in Michigan, there's something that goes beyond lawmakers that we can't really score in the Faith and Freedom Index, right? We're just ranking objectively what are the state laws on the books that have been passed by the legislature. Sometimes we're looking at regulations, but there is a kind of intangible, right? There's the political or cultural climate where even if Michigan had good laws on the books, if they had, well, the attorney general that they currently have there, who's aggressively, you know, enforcing laws against Catholic schools, against religious right. organizations, you might not be able to rate for that, but it is a factor. So we wouldn't necessarily tell people, just look at the laws in the index and go incorporate your nonprofit there, because You're right. The attorney general, the governor, these positions matter greatly, whether they have good or bad laws. If you have hostile people or friendly people in the administration, it makes a big difference on enforcement.
Talking with Frank DeVito, Napa Legal Institute Senior Counsel and Director of Content, the third annual Faith and Freedom Index is out. We're discussing the details this morning. So, Frank, I'm thinking that this has a chilling effect on, you're mentioning organizations, obviously nonprofits, but on movements in these states that are very badly rated, such as my home state of Michigan, because we've always had a really strong pro-life state in terms of the people. Right to Life of Michigan has always been very, very good, other pro-life organizations. But that does have a chilling effect when you see these numbers and the statistics, right?
Yeah, it absolutely does. And, you know, there's a problem where some laws you can get around, right? If there are bad corporate governance laws in your state, some people will just incorporate their organization in a different state, right? You might have a Michigan organization that's incorporated as a Delaware nonprofit or a Wyoming nonprofit. Out of the nation laws, the state religious liberty laws, you can't get around those without physically leaving the state, right? So at a certain point, it matters. And it is to the point where you have the chilling effect of, do people really want to go to a place like Michigan or like Washington State that's pretty obviously persecuting religious exercise? It's definitely dissuading people from starting organizations or from opening up shop in those places. And then beyond that, you do have questions of how you behave, right? Like, you might have a Catholic school that wants to hire in accordance with its faith, obviously, right? It wants teachers and staff that actually live Catholic principles. But if you have the kind of enforcement and the kind of laws that's going on in Michigan, a lot of these schools might think twice about what they can even get away with. They're questioning whether, well, can we actually hire, you know, based on religion, based on our creedal statements? I don't know. It looks like the attorney general might come after us. So I agree. Huge chilling effect on whether and where to start an organization at all, and then how you behave once you're operating.
Yeah, yes, because then you have to think about, and you know this, you know, as someone who does legal work, that's your life's work. You think about, am I going to have to spend so much money and so much time in court in order to even function, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, not to mention with some of the other factors we rate, right, the burdensome amounts of paperwork, administrative filing, thousands of dollars in fees to comply with a lot of these state laws, right, plus the looming threat of, am I going to get the attorney general knocking at my door? Am I going to end up in court for making a hiring decision based on obvious tenets of the Catholic faith? Yeah, it's a huge problem. It can actually completely cripple the ability of an organization to function at all.
I think it's huge that you're doing this. It's really helpful. This is your third annual. We have about a minute left. What prompted you? Was there certain incidents or things that happened that prompted you to start doing this particular index?
So the reason we did it is Napa Legal exists to educate faith-based nonprofits on the types of laws that they have to know about and comply with so they don't get in trouble in the first place. So as we were doing this work and educating nonprofits over the years, our leadership realized, hey, we should actually do a state-by-state study and rank these and show people who's doing this right and who isn't.
Great. All right, Frank, we're going to take a quick break. Then we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the importance of this index and where various states stand. And also, if you live in one of these states, such as my home state of Michigan, that is not doing well in these categories, what can we do as a people of faith to make sure that we are able to speak freely and have these organizations function so they can make a difference? We're talking with Frank DeVito, the Napa Legal Institute Senior Counsel and Director of Content, the third annual Faith and Freedom Index. And as you heard, Alabama, number one, Michigan, the Great Lakes State, at the bottom. We'll find out who's kind of in the middle, maybe the higher ups and the lower thirds. Who knows? We'll see. We'll figure it out. Frank joins us again for another segment. Stay tuned. You're listening to Catholic Connection, an EWTM production on this Veterans Day. We'll be right back. Seven minutes past the hour now on a Tuesday morning. It's November 11th, Veterans Day. Having a very important conversation with Frank DeVito, Napa Legal Institute Senior Counsel and Director of Content regarding the third annual Faith and Freedom Index. So, Frank, we were talking before we took a quick break that, you know, just wondering what this means for organizations, nonprofits who are in states like mine, like Michigan. How are they doing and what can they do differently or maybe better to make sure that they're not swallowed up by all of this?
Right. It's a great question. And, you know, it depends on the ministry. It depends on how rooted and state-specific and necessary it is, right? Because for some organizations, people will actually take a look and say, it's getting too hard to function in Michigan. This isn't really worth the administrative burden, the fear of litigation, the cost of complying with all of this. So we have actually seen organizations that will pick up and move. But for most, as you've said, you know, they're rooted in their community. They're there for Michigan, and that's who they're serving. So you just have to navigate the landscape as best as you can. So that means a couple things. I mean, to plug our own organization, NAPA Legal exists to help educate faith-based nonprofits on how to navigate the legal climate where they are. So we have a lot of resources to help issue spot, really, to start seeing, okay, well, here's where your state has problematic laws. Here's where your practice or your ministry probably conflicts with some of those. So here are the tension points, and here's what we can do to work through that. And one example that it's not a cure-all, but I think it's really important, is over the last few decades, as religion became maybe a little less culturally accepted, right? We went from a society where being Christian was kind of necessary to thrive in society to now society's kind of hostile to it. So what we've seen is religious organizations kind of trying to play down their religious identity, right? If religious schools who maybe want to say, oh, well, yes, we're in the Catholic tradition, but we don't really focus on being a religious organization. You know, they're kind of gun shy. Same thing with a lot of charities who maybe serve the poor, the homeless. They've kind of de-emphasized their religious identity and focused on the secular, like, service element. And we would say that actually this is one of the biggest problems and one of the things that can most be remedied to help organizations to protect themselves, because, you know, you have the First Amendment that protects the free exercise of religion. You often have exemptions to certain laws for religious organizations, and courts will not just assume, oh, well, you say you're religious, then okay, you're religious. They will actually look into, when there are issues, how religious are you, right? If you're trying to take advantage of the ministerial exception to say that you're, you know, the government can't interfere in your hiring and firing decisions, are you really a religious organization? Is it in your bylaws? Is it in your articles of incorporation? Is it in your employment agreements? Does your organization pray together? Do they look like a real religious organization? This can be the difference between whether you can take advantage of religious protections under the law or not. Mm-hmm. So that's a big one, even in hostile states. Is like if you look and walk and talk like a religious organization, then you can take advantage of the protections for religious organizations.
So what other states fared pretty well in the index besides Alabama?
Yeah, so the top five are Alabama, Kansas, Indiana, Texas, Mississippi, and Georgia is six. They have a lot in common with what I had said about Alabama in the beginning. You know, maybe this is a good time to talk about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, if you'd, we can go there for a minute. So this is an important one. And you will find that all the states that are in, I'm just looking at my list, the top 10, 12, 13, all have one of these, because we weigh it very highly for a reason. So really quickly, in 1990, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case called Employment Division versus Smith, where the Supreme Court very seriously narrowed the application of the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. So basically, the Supreme Court held, if there's a law that's neutral and generally applicable, right, it's not targeting religion, it's not targeting a certain subset of people, it applies to everyone, even if it actually burdens religious exercise, we're going to say it doesn't run afoul of the Free Exercise Clause of the First Amendment. It created a lot of problems. You can imagine, right, if a law said Catholics can't buy wine, that's not neutral, it's not generally applicable, it's obviously discriminatory, that's going to fail Free Exercise Clause. But if you just have a law that says nobody can buy wine, even if Catholics need it to have the mass, that's neutral, generally applicable. It's probably going to be something that you can't use the First Amendment to get around. So it created a real problem. And what the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is a statute that basically bypasses that and says, okay, if the First Amendment doesn't protect religious exercise from general neutral laws, then we do by statute, and it forces courts to protect religious individuals and organizations, even if neutral laws are burdening their religious exercise. So there are 30 states, I believe, I think it's 30 right now, in the United States that have Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, which means there are about 20 that do not.
So do those in states like Michigan and others that don't have RFRA, do they need to start working toward that? Would that be effective, an effective way to change the climate in their states?
So practically, yes. In theory, yes. But politically, it's very difficult. I mean, even in more conservative states, you've seen there was that fight in Indiana a number of years ago when Vice President Pence had been governor, where he got gun shy. They ended up amending and weakening the Religious Freedom Restoration Act before it was signed. So it's a hard thing. I would say, again, politics is not what I do for an Apple Legal, but in any but the most robust states, it's very hard to pass them right now because you have LGBTQ lobbies come in and say, you know, this is just a pretext to discriminate against our people, and it becomes a big, loud political fight with a lot of money behind it. That being said, in the last year, Georgia passed one and Wyoming passed one just in this last year. Utah was last year. So it was originally a movement that came in the years after those Supreme Court cases in the 90s. But in the past 3 years, I would say, since we started the index, another five or six states have passed them. So that is a heartening trend that we've seen again.
What's great about your organization, though, is that you're there to help people. You don't just put out these numbers and say, oh, sorry, if you're in Michigan or one of these other states, good luck. I mean, you do have assistance and help for people that really help educate and just get them connected with other people maybe feeling the same pinch, right?
Yes, that's a lot. So a lot of what we do, the founding purpose, as I said, is to help educate nonprofits, you know, faith-based nonprofits. They run charitable organizations. They run a little school, a crisis pregnancy center. They have limited funds. They have a heart for their mission. They usually don't have a heart for, like, legal compliance and corporate governance, right? That's not why you get into this. So, but you need to be protected. And so what we found was there are a lot of these organizations that could really benefit from at least some basic education of what they need to do to protect themselves, even if they can't afford, nonprofit expert lawyers on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. So we founded the organization, started to write materials, and now I've been recording video series, lectures, things like that. We have a lot of resources. So we bring people into the network. We try to get them educated as nonprofit leaders to do these things. And then if there's something that goes beyond our ability to teach them through educational resources, then we have a nationwide network of attorneys, and we can refer people to attorneys who can specialize and help them with their problems.
Is there an opportunity for nonprofits to talk to other nonprofits through your website?
Yeah, so we have a number of we try to do a quarterly webinar, so we'll have like a roundtable discussion with nonprofits about any particular like hot legal issues that we think are most relevant to them. And then we have an in-person summit, a conference as well, out in Napa every summer. So then the last 2 years we've done that and had 40 to 50 nonprofit leaders get together and spend the time to learn and also network and get to know each other and share in the struggles.
Awesome. Thank you for this information, Frank. Really appreciate it. The website, by the way, for more information, NapaLegalInstitute.org. Again, NapaLegalInstitute.org. We'll be right back. Hour. Great to be with you on a Tuesday. It's November 11, 2025, and great to follow up on Tepeyac Leadership's Hour of the Laity Conference, which took place recently down in beautiful Mexico City. And of course, Our Lady of Guadalupe was a big focus of that conference, as well as what we as laity can do to make a difference. Christopher Padata is the CEO of Tepeyac Leadership, and he's on the phone with us to kind of give us an update. So Christopher, how did it go? Thanks for joining us again.
Oh, Teresa, thank you so much for the invitation. We had such a blessed, lovely, Holy Spirit-filled, grace-filled time. It was a gift.
So how many people did you end up having in terms of attendees?
Yeah, it was smaller than our previous conference. It really was a very intimate experience. It was about 60 people, where in the past we had about 250. We expected that because we knew we were asking our conference attendees to do something they haven't done before, which is travel outside the United States. Some Americans are a little hesitant about going to Mexico, but it was good because it was our first experience doing it. We're going to do it again next year, and people will know over time that we host our conference annually in Mexico City. That's the plan, and that we can do it safely and in a very impactful way.
I think it's awesome, and I think it's wonderful to have advantage to see the Tilma and to be there, you know, for Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is phenomenal. So what was the response just from being there at such a special place, first of all?
Just being in the presence of the actual image of Our Lady of Guadalupe, right? The Tilma of Juan Diego. That in itself, I mean, it's worth the trip. But we had a terrific, just top-notch group of speakers. You know, one thing we do is we really recruit from all over the world. We go in-house. Our former Tepeyac leaders, the people that years ago were going through the program and now are out and about as leaders, making a difference in their own communities. We had some speakers from Spain, from Costa Rica. The whole content is in English, but it's very international. And, of course, many American speakers and panelists during these discussions. It was all about going deep into understanding the role of the laity, our mm-hmm. mission. And also, the theme of the conference was the Pope's new motto, in the One Christ, we are one. So it was all about unity, exploring what leadership, a unifying leadership from the laity means, what that looks like. And I walked away with a lot of nuggets that I can put into practice. I think the other participants as well.
So can you give us one or two of those nuggets? Because I think it's super important for all of us as laity to have an understanding of the important role we play
yes.
in the church.
I would say the most important one, Teresa, the Pope is such a great role model of this, which is simply having the ability, which we have lost as a society, to listen to one another, just to listen, just to talk. You know, we assume people don't want to hear what we have to say. We assume we're not going to be interested in what others have to say because we know that they're coming from a different direction, and we start to segment ourselves and divide ourselves and think of ourselves in categories. And I think we need to remember that we are all human beings and that we all have something important to say, that we should at least listen to what the other has to say. That was a theme that continued to resonate throughout the conference.
And I think that's so important. As a matter of fact, in prepping for the show today, I was looking at a news site and saw this horrible story about violence and an uprising of these leftist students that came onto the Berkeley campus and tried to disrupt a Turning Point USA event. I'm thinking, wait a minute, aren't college campuses supposed to be a place where we can hear each other out mm-hmm. and we can express ideas? And that is just, unfortunately, I think, in so many ways, as you said, even sometimes in the church, gone by the wayside. We have to be able to listen to each other.
Absolutely, 100%. I think that is a big message that came out of the conference. And now we're really excited about putting together the next cohort of our signature flagship formation program, Tepeyac Leadership Initiative. Is really, really looking as a solid group of Catholic professionals from around the country and around the world. As you know, next year we're launching the first Spanish version for the first time of our program exclusively for Latin America. So we're going to be forming, as always, a group of people from the United States, from Europe, from all over the English Catholic-speaking world, but also another group will be made out of people from everywhere, from Mexico down to Argentina.
Wow, that's exciting. And
it
your conference
exciting.
Next year is back in Mexico City, right?
Yes, for us, it really, even though it was the first time we did it there, our apostolate from the beginning had dedicated his work and as for the intercession of Our Lady of Guadalupe and Juan Diego, that's why we named it Tepeyac. We also use consistently the image of Juan Diego as one of a lay leader, as someone who mm-hmm. didn't initially see himself as leader, as able to carry out an important mission.
That's a great point. Wow, yeah.
For us, we meet Juan Diegos every year in our program, people who mm-hmm. are gifted and God has given so many talents. And they don't see themselves as leaders. And the program helps them to get there and to find their leadership commitment is what we call them. So it's very special for us. It feels like coming home, going to Mexico City. And we think it's a good fit. There are a lot of conferences in the United States, a lot of terrific, wonderful Catholic conferences, but we were trying to find a way to set ourselves apart and offer something different, and we think this is a good fit because we've always been about Our Lady of Guadalupe, Juan Diego, mm-hmm. and Tepeyac.
Now, what about speakers for next year? Any ideas yet, or do you have a list?
Well, actually, no. we at this point, no. We're just fresh off this conference. We typically, early in the year, we think about a team. This is the way we do it. I think perhaps other events might start with a list of people who they'd like to have in their conference. The way we do it is we start with a team and we create a program and we think about the topics. And then we begin to plug in. We begin to think who would be a good person to invite to do this talk or sit on this panel discussion. And we tend to go in-house. We're not really, we don't tap too much into the Catholic speaking circuit. Rather, we like to promote our own Tepeyac leaders and give them an opportunity mm-hmm. to come up the stage and lead.
I think that's a great idea. We're talking with Christopher Panetta. He's the CEO of Tepeyac Leadership. They're fresh off their recent annual conference and looking forward to next year's conference. One of the things that I always think about and pray about is I wish all of us in the laity would understand that over the centuries, since the church began, actually, the laity, if you think about it, at the end of the day, when there's a big crisis in the church, who's the one that turns the church around? It's usually the laity, right?
We are the majority of the church. And I don't think Jesus ever meant for the clergy, for the bishops and the priests to be the only ones to carry on their shoulders the weight of leading in the church and in the world. And particularly if we read and study the teachings of the church, particularly through the Second Vatican Council, we will understand clearly that the mission of infusing society, secular society, with the values of the gospel, transforming society from within, that is the mission of the laity. And we can do it in ways that our beloved bishops and even the Pope cannot do, precisely because of their state in life and our state in life.
How are you drawn to this area of ministry in terms of helping the laity understand their role, Christopher? What was it? Was there a particular instance or incident in your life that prompted you to get so involved in this?
Actually, it was a series of things, but the starting point probably was as I was serving Bishop Olmsted to work for the Diocese of Phoenix. I was once sent to a secular civic leadership development program here in town. And going through that experience opened my eyes to the reality of civic leadership development in the United States. Teresa, this concept has been around since the 70s. There's such a thing as the National Association of Leadership Programs, which has about 200 members. The members are large nonprofit organizations that are doing this. They take on names like Leadership Philadelphia, Leadership Los Angeles. They're all in all the main big cities and even small cities. What are they doing? They're inviting professionals to their training. Each one takes on a different flavor or shape and really pushing them into key leadership positions in their community. Unfortunately, I discovered when I was experiencing one of these programs myself that the majority of these programs are forming leaders with values that run directly opposed to Catholic teaching.
Wow.
So no wonder we have the leaders that we have in America, in the world, right? These are the programs where many of our public elected officials get their feet wet in terms of leadership. This is where they form their networks and tap into resources. And not just politics, people in the for-profit, non-profit sector. This is sort of a secret, something that happens kind of under the radar. I mean, it's not, people know it's there, but the ones that need to know. So when we saw this, when I saw this, Bishop Olmsted and I, 8 years ago, no, 9 years ago now, we thought, gosh, this is actually a novel concept because who could be against the idea of forming leaders? Unfortunately, it's not being oriented right, but we thought we can do this better because we can make it Catholic. And that's how Tepeyac Leadership was born.
Yeah, and this is just so crucial because if you look at, and you're right, why people are in powerful positions, they start out at the lowest levels. They start out maybe at, you know, at the high school, maybe they're on the board of education, or maybe they're, you know, literally a dog catcher or someone working at the county level, and then they just keep moving up and up and up. So it's really important to start, you know, at the levels of the local. You know, they say all politics are local. It's true. You start at that level, but that's where you have your start with your influence, right?
Absolutely. And if you read our book we published a few years ago, available on Amazon, Catholic Leadership for Civil Society, we dedicated a whole chapter, and during the program, our flagship program, TLI, we dedicate a whole session to board service, precisely what you just mm-hmm. mentioned. Mm-hmm. Because as we mm-hmm. we tell our students, board service is where leadership happens. And by boards, we actually have broadened the definition of board service because we do mean real boards, advisory boards, boards of directors, boards of trustees. But we also mean your student government body, as you mentioned, or your professional association or guild. Imagine the influence the American Psychiatric Association or the bar of lawyers have in the standards of the industry and the things that take place. And you can think of every arena, right? But don't stop there. We tell our students, listen, think also about your local Lions Clubs, Rotary Clubs, Homeowners yep. Association, mm-hmm. Parent Teacher Association, every table where decisions are made. This is where we need more faithful and committed Catholic voices.
Amen. Well said. So, Christopher, how do we find out about next year's conference? And if folks are interested in learning more about Tepeyac leadership in general, where did they go?
So the conference exact dates will be announced early next year. And I can already say here announced that Archbishop Gomez has verbally accepted to join us. So Bishop Olmsted and Archbishop Gomez.
Wow.
There's a few other surprises. But the main thing right now, I would invite your audience, is to think about joining our TLI program. That is really the most profound in-depth formation experience that we offer. It's a one-time experience, 5 months, 18 weeks. The deadline to apply for TLI was yesterday, Teresa, but I am happy to grant an extension to your audience till the end of this week, Friday.
If
they are willing to go to TLIprogram.org, and apply to be in the TLI 2026 cohort.
That's awesome. Christopher, thank you so much. God bless you and your work. And I'm so excited you have Bishop Gomez, Archbishop Gomez, and also, of course, a mutual favorite of both of ours, Bishop Olmsted. And they're both wonderful leaders in the church. And I know they'll have a lot to share with those who attend. God bless you. And Our Lady of Guadalupe, pray for us.
Thank you.
It is a Tuesday. You're welcome, Christopher. Thanks so much. We'll make sure we put the website out there as well. We'll be right back to let you know what's coming up in hour number two of Catholic Connection on EWTN's Radio Extra. Stay tuned. Don't forget to thank a veteran today for their service to the United States of America. God bless all of our veterans. Hope you're having a great day. It is a Tuesday, November 11th, again, Veterans Day in the United States of America. Coming up in the second hour of Catholic Connection on EWTN's Radio Extra, we're going to take a look at, don't you just love it, the state of Pennsylvania. You think Michigan is bad? Well, there are some issues in my husband's home state of Pennsylvania where he was born and raised. So the Pennsylvania officials think it's a good idea to have a media literacy program for kids, and the resources in the media literacy kit, guess what outlets they're using? What do you think? Well, the BBC, and who else? Oh, I think they will, and I think, gosh, what was the other one? Al Jazeera, NPR, Public Broadcasting. BBC is in the middle of a big scandal regarding activism within the newsroom, sloppy editing, purposely, you know, changing quotes from people. I mean, it's just unbelievable what they're doing at the BBC, and they're being called out for it, but they're still claiming they're not biased at all. And yet somehow the state of Pennsylvania thinks this is a good resource for kids in their media literacy kit. We'll take a look at that. And speaking of education, we are going to be checking in, as we always do, with the Cardinal Newman Society's Kelly Solomon for our Newman Guide News. And we'll take a look at that story that I just mentioned, as well as the story I mentioned earlier with the Napa Legal Institute, where, and also with Christopher, where one college campus among many not allowing other voices to be heard. All that coming up next on the second hour of Catholic Connection, EWTN Radio Extra. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, keeping you connected to your faith and your world. Teresa tackles the issues of faith and culture, the pro-life message, and media awareness. And now, here's Teresa Tomeo.
on a Tuesday, Veterans Day, here on EWTN Radio Extra. Also, the Feast of St. Martin de Tours, wonderful saint, of course. We have a great show for you today, and it's a Tuesday, which means we're going to weigh in with our good friend Kelly Solomon for our Newman Guide News. Great news from the Cardinal Newman Society. Some interesting news, some uplifting news, and also some, well, shocking news to give you the scoop on what's happening in not only higher education, but in schools across the board. And we're going to start out our discussion on schools and education this morning by a story that just, it just got my Italian up. So I received an email from a friend of mine this morning about this press release that's gone out about what's happening in the state of Pennsylvania, where they think it's a good idea. The school system there, supported by the governor, thinks it's a great idea for media literacy. Okay, media literacy can be a very good thing, which teaches us how to use the media well and wisely and helps us understand how media operate. But it can also be very dangerous in terms of agendas and brainwashing. And the outlets that are involved in the media literacy kit in terms of resources for K through 12 students in the state of Pennsylvania, well, they're utterly ridiculous in terms of not being legitimate organizations, because several of them are being called out majorly, most recently the BBC, for extreme institutional bias. The BBC just fired two top people because an internal memo went out about the hatchet job they did, among other things, on a story involving the president of the United States, Donald Trump. And yet this is one of the outlets that the state of Pennsylvania thinks is great for the kids to use in terms of their media literacy. Alrighty then. And so we'll talk with Kelly Solomon about that. But I do want to dive into this story a little bit more deeply, because more information is coming out about the problematic BBC. The problem is this is not an outlier situation with the BBC. This has happened with NPR. We see this with other outlets. We see what happened with 60 Minutes and the infamous now Kamala Harris interview before the election. What's happening are many people in the media feel themselves, see themselves as activists rather than journalists. They basically put on a mask and claim to be reporters, claim to be caring about journalism and the who, what, where, when, why, and how, when all they really care about is making sure that their agendas are getting out there and they help the politicians that support their agendas. And we see it over and over and over again. And the BBC is certainly right in that category. And this is for Europe, of course, a British broadcasting corporation. So we'll discuss coming up at 2 cents. And we'll also take a look at that with Kelly Solomon from the Cardinal Newman Society. Weather-wise, what are we looking at? While still very frigid cold in the eastern part of the U.S. and snow continuing in the Great Lakes, we have a frigid cold air mass that continues to bring colder weather across the eastern two-thirds of the country early this week. Record low temperatures are expected to be tied or broken across the southeast in Florida, and periods of snow continuing downwind of the Great Lakes and in portions of interior New England through this afternoon, with several inches of snowfall accumulation expected. Wow, several inches, and it's only early November. Well, it is a Tuesday morning. We are so glad you're listening to the second hour of A Catholic Connection on EWTN Radio Extra. Let's get started and see what's happening in the news on this Veterans Day. Well, the Senate voting last night to end the government shutdown.
On this vote, the ayes are 60, the nays are 40. The bill, as amended, is passed.
Chamber voting last night to pass a funding bill, which now goes to the House. Republican Senator Susan Collins says passage of the measure is good news for federal workers.
We are going to reopen government. We're going to ensure that federal employees, whether they were furloughed or laid off or forced to work without pay, will now receive compensation.
The measure would fund the government through January. It passed on a 60-40 vote. The House, though, not expected to take up the bill until Wednesday. That's tomorrow at the earliest. The president says, however, the government will be opening quickly. Speaking to reporters at the White House, he said he approves. Trump said he approves of the deal struck between Republicans and just a handful of Democrats.
The deal is very good. We're not going to be giving $1.5 trillion to people that came in from jails and from, the gangs and drug dealers and all of these others.
Meanwhile, the president also saying in an interview on Fox News that he believes Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer went way over the top in the shutdown fight.
Well, I think he made a mistake in going too far.
Going too far? How?
He just went too far. He thought he could break the Republicans, and the Republicans broke him.
In that Fox News interview, Trump discussing a series of topics, also saying he was not pleased at all when he saw the air traffic controller staffing issues in recent days. Rory O'Neill tells us in other news this morning, the families of six campers and two counselors killed in Texas floods are now filing major lawsuits some 5 months after those deaths.
Two separate lawsuits were filed Monday, one by the family of camper Lulu Peck and the other by the families of five campers and two counselors who died in the 4th of July weekend tragedy. Both lawsuits accuse Camp Mystic, the Eastland family, and the camp's management companies of negligence and wrongful death. Each lawsuit seeks more than $1 million in damages. In all, 25 campers died along with the two counselors during that natural disaster. I'm Rory O'Neill.
The U.S. Supreme Court yesterday declining a request to overturn its 2015 decision to legalize same-sex marriage. Kim Davis, you may recall, a former county clerk in Kentucky, petitioned the high court in July to reconsider that 2015 ruling, which legalized same-sex civil marriages nationally. She requested the court also hear her case 10 years later after she made headlines for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples. She served multiple days in jail for contempt of court for violating a judicial order to issue the marriage licenses. She was also ordered to pay more than $360,000 in damages and legal fees for violating a same-sex couple's right to marry. After lower courts rejected her claim that the Constitution's First Amendment right to free exercise of religion protected her in the case, she appealed to the Supreme Court. The Trump administration did not weigh in on the case as the high court considered whether to take up the matter. The Supreme Court, according to the Catholic News Agency, making the decision to reject the request yesterday and has made no comment on that matter. And Paul Batty, author of many well-known books, such as Benedict Up Close, A Face of God and a True Icon, passed away early yesterday morning at the age of 77 after a long illness. He was also a veteran contributor to EWTN and Catholic News Agency's German language news partner. He was born on March 10th in 1948 in Germany in a small village on the Rhine River. He studied philosophy and sociology as well as art history and political science. Before embarking on a journalistic career, he worked as a teacher for several years. As a reporter, he served for many years as a Jerusalem correspondent before moving to Rome. He was also one of the founding editors of Vatican Magazine. He died in his beloved Montepello in the Italian Abruzzo region. Paul and his wife Ellen had five children. And Pope Leo says AI use in healthcare must ensure quality of care and relationships. As Devin Watkins reports on Vatican News, the Pope sending a message to a special medical conference and their participants, offering his prayerful good wishes for the event at the Vatican for their discussions about the use of artificial intelligence in healthcare.
In his message, the Pope noted the pervasive influence of AI and other technological advances on humanity. He said our interaction with AI heavily influences the way we think and alters how we perceive ourselves and others. We currently interact with machines as if they were interlocutors and thus become almost an extension of them, he said. We not only run the risk of losing sight of the faces of the people around us, but of forgetting how to recognize and cherish all that is truly human. Pope Leo highlighted the benefits technological developments have brought to the fields of medicine and health. However, he added, true progress requires that individuals and public entities uphold human dignity and the common good. Though AI and other technologies can be used to devastating effect on humanity when used maliciously, those same technologies have the potential to be transformative and beneficial if placed at the true service of the human person, said the Pope. He then focused on the irreplaceable nature of human relationships in providing care for individuals.
He also told those taking part in the conference at the Vatican that they must have both the expertise to offer care and the ability to communicate effectively while expressing closeness to their patients. Healthcare, he said, cannot be reduced to solving a problem, adding technological devices must never take away from the patient-carer relationship. At least 18 people were hurt at Dulles International Airport in Virginia after a mobile lounge, also known as a people mover, struck a dock. The Metropolitan Washington Airport Authority saying the lounge was taking passengers across the airport when it struck the dock at an angle. Authorities initially said just 8 people had been taken to the hospital, but later raising that number all the way up to 18. The injuries are considered non-life-threatening. New York City honoring those who have served our country on this Veterans Day. The annual Veterans Day Parade marching up Fifth Avenue starting at 25th Street begins at 12:30. This year's parade marks the 250-year anniversary of the start of the Revolutionary War. That's when the U.S. Army, Navy, and Marines were formed. The Veterans Day wreath-laying ceremony takes place at Madison Square Park at 11 o'clock, an hour from now or so. And meanwhile, there will also be ceremonies at the Intrepid Sea, Air, and Space Museum at 3:30 this afternoon. And Monica Nelson tells us today is Veterans Day, and along with that comes an increased focus on the sensitive topic of suicide.
The most recent data available from the Department of Veterans Affairs noted an average of 17.6 suicides per day among veterans, a rate that's far higher than the general non-veteran population. If you are a veteran in crisis or know someone who is, the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline can be reached 24/7 by calling 988. I'm Monica Nelson.
President Trump will visit Arlington National Cemetery today. The president expected to lay a wreath, of course, at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier and deliver remarks as part of an official observance ceremony. This year's Veterans Day proclamation from the White House notes that the story of America is written with the courage, honor, and dedicated service of our veterans. Secretary of War Pete Hegseth says U.S. carried out strikes on two more alleged drug boats over the weekend. The strikes took place on the Eastern Pacific yesterday, killing six people. In a post on X, he said the vessels are known by U.S. intelligence to be associated with illicit narcotics smuggling. Over 70 people so far have been killed in more than a dozen strikes that began in September. Jack Cronin tells us a woman in a stolen minivan managed to cross the border from San Diego into Mexico after a three-hour chase across Southern California.
The car chase started at 10:30 a.m. in Thousand Oaks, with law enforcement chasing the woman across Ventura, Los Angeles, Orange, and San Diego counties. She led highway patrol down the 5 and 805 freeways in San Diego before making it to the San Ysidro port of entry and crossing into Mexico. There were no injuries or crashes during the three-hour chase. I'm Jack Cronin.
And Wizard of Oz fans will soon have the chance to own one of the most iconic costume pieces from the film. Margaret Hamilton's original Wicked Witch of the West black hat going up for auction in December. It will be part of Heritage Auctions' December Hollywood signature event. The auction will also include Judy Garland's red rehearsal slipper and a cast-signed copy of L. Frank Baum's The Wonderful Wizard of Oz book. Other items that will be a part of the auction include Elvis Presley's 1976 Harley-Davidson, Marilyn Monroe's Cleopatra costume, and artwork from Star Wars as well. It is a Tuesday morning, the Feast of St. Martin de Tours, and also, of course, Veterans Day. Wishing you a beautiful day. Don't forget, several parts of the country today and for several days are going to be very chilly. We have a frigid cold air mass continuing to bring colder weather across the eastern two-thirds of the country, and that will take place today and probably for parts of tomorrow. Record low temperatures are expected to be tied or broken across the southeast and even down in Florida. And then periods of snow continuing downwind of the Great Lakes and in portions of interior New England through this afternoon. Up next, taking a look at the state of Pennsylvania and their idea of so-called media literacy. You won't believe it, but then again, maybe, given the state of our media, you will. We'll be right back. The state of Pennsylvania touting media literacy for children while pushing left-wing sources. That is a headline from a news release. This is yet more evidence that government schools cannot be trusted under the guise of battling disinformation. The state promotes outlets riddled with leftist propaganda masquerading as news reporting. All right, let me read this press release to you. Then we're going to play a clip of someone responding to what's happening specifically with the BBC, which is in the midst of a bias scandal. I mean, it's a huge story. The Telegraph broke the story last week, and it's all over the place, and even some of the media are reporting it. But it shows you just how bad the BBC are, very similar to NPR, public broadcasting here in the States. All right. The state of Pennsylvania is pushing media literacy toolkits in K through 12 schools that guide children toward news sources, and news sources in particular in this case that have a pronounced leftist bias. NPR, the BBC, The Guardian, Reuters, Al Jazeera, The Hill, Vox, and AP are listed in the State Department of Education's toolkit as trusted sources, even though they relentlessly run cover for Democrats and left-wing causes and smear conservatives at all costs. And the Federalist magazine, by the way, online reported the kit only lists one conservative site, the Dispatch. This is yet more evidence that government schools cannot be trusted. This is according to the founder and president of the U.S. Parents Involved in Education program. Under the guise of battling disinformation, the state promotes outlets riddled, as we mentioned earlier, with leftist propaganda masquerading as news reporting. In recent weeks, the Democratic Governor Josh Shapiro and the acting Secretary of Education, Carrie Rowe, have been visiting schools and promoting the toolkit as a way to counter disinformation. Okay, here we go. However, corporate media at large has downplayed and denied leftist violence, peddled debunked hoaxes, misrepresented conservatives, or blatantly lied to push left-wing narratives. The aftermath, for example, of the assassination of Charlie Kirk brought the trend in full force when outlets used their coverage of Kirk's brutal killing to smear the conservatives' icon's reputation or cast his killer as MAGA. There is a real problem with deepfakes and other garbage on the internet, but pretending that clearly biased sources are a reliable alternative is not the answer. The story points out the risk to parents who might naively think trusted sources are to be actually trusted. Again, this is a quote from the president of United States Parents Involved in Education. Shapiro visiting Middletown Area High School near Harrisburg recently to highlight the information and media literacy toolkit for students, teachers, and parents that was unveiled in September of last year. The toolkit steers viewers to state and external resources to learn about misinformation and disinformation. In addition to left-leaning news sources, the toolkit links to several pages within the Boston Children's Media Wellness Lab, the Federalist reported. The lab is supported by arguably some of the most powerful enemies of children's well-being online, including TikTok and Discord. All right. So, we mentioned what they're doing in the state of Pennsylvania with this so-called media literacy program, trying to pass off these different outlets as legitimate news sources. Well, the BBC is right now involved in a major, major scandal. And this has to do with bias, all right? And, for example, how they basically took an interview, actually not an interview, but the speech that Donald Trump gave on January 6, 2021, and chopped it and put it together. And this is all in a memo, by the way, and that's what happened. The Telegraph released this memo and made it seem as if the president was promoting violence. All right. Telegraph journalist who revealed BBC Dr. Donald Trump's speech expresses genuine shock at the extent of scandal after Director General's resignation. Okay. It's unbelievable. Associate editor for the Telegraph, Gordon Rayner, who broke the news that the BBC had doctored Donald Trump's January 6th speech, has revealed even he was genuinely shocked when he learned Director General Tim Davey had turned a blind eye to the fiasco. Mr. Davey and BBC Chief Executive of News, Deborah Turness, confirmed yesterday they would step down following significant criticism and accusations of systematic bias at the broadcaster. Critics have accused the BBC of failing to maintain political neutrality in its reporting, including in its coverage of Donald Trump, the Israeli-Hamas war, and trans rights issues. So it's not just one story. It's several stories. Now, okay, last year they started this program in Pennsylvania with this media literacy thing. But you would think that given everything that's happened in the last several months, that the state of Pennsylvania would say, oh, wait a minute, we have to rethink this and maybe provide some different sources for this so-called media literacy kit for kids, all right, grades K through 12. So I want to run a little bit of an interview with Josh Hammer, who's a Newsweek senior editor at large. He's reflecting on the latest fiasco at BBC. He's being interviewed by the anchor from the Australian version of Sky News, where they have their own problems with a very similar Australian broadcasting company. Take a listen.
We fight like hell. We're going to walk down to the Capitol, and we're going to cheer on our brave senators and congressmen and women.
Ooh, I like the sinister music they played in that doctored version. Just to drive the point home, obviously. So how did that happen? Let's hear from The Telegraph's Gordon Rayner, who explains just how deliberate and dishonest the BBC were in manufacturing this bit of fake news, this rewriting of history.
The BBC spliced together two clips that took place 54 minutes apart.
We're going to walk down to the Capitol. And we fight. We fight like hell.
They played that episode a week before the US election, obviously hoping for maximum impact, but they were caught, and for once there were consequences. The BBC's Director General Tim Davey and Head of News Deborah Turness have now been forced to step down. Joining me is Newsweek Senior Editor-at-Large and Article 3 Project Senior Counsel Josh Hammer. Josh, it is often the ones who scream loudest about misinformation who are guilty of what we just saw.
Well, that's quite possibly, Rita, the single most brazenly dishonest thing that I've ever seen the media do. And I want to just pause and kind of mold it over a second, because that's a very big statement that I just made. But that is outrageous. I mean, the Kamala Harris 60 Minutes CBS News interview definitely comes to mind. I mean, let's not forget just how bad the CBS News tried to make the Kamala word salad come across as something remotely palatable in the final months of the 2024 election. That was absolutely horrific in its own right. But this is astonishing. Thank goodness there's been some accountability. I mean, someone has resigned there. But why are the British people paying for this? Why are the British people subjected out of their hard-earned taxpayer money? And, you know, the economy in the UK has not exactly been rocking and roaring for a number of decades now. So it's not exactly like people have money to splurge around, but they're subsidizing this crap. They're subsidizing this. I mean, here in the United States, we're subsidizing PBS and NPR. Well, I mean, Trump's taken some steps actually to finally extricate ourselves from that toxic bear hug of relationship with our taxpayer funded media overlords. But at the barest of bare minimums, it's just one of many reasons why the public should not be engaged in the direct subsidization of media. This is utterly egregious stuff. I would like to see someone no less than Keir Starmer himself just condemn this and say this is not helpful. After all, last I checked, the US and the UK still had something going back to the Reagan-Thatcher days, probably even longer back to Churchill-FDR, called the special relationship. If you guys actually care about the special relationship, you probably should stop doing things like this. That's just some helpful advice, shall we say.
And to think, as you just heard, the editor of Newsweek and the anchor from, of course, Sky News Australia, talking about the very problematic BBC. And yes, the BBC is at the top of this list for so-called reliable sources that are included in the state of Pennsylvania's media literacy kit for K through 12 graders. According to the Federalist, a parent from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, a public high school, shared the quote-unquote trusted sources list with the magazine, including in the student's civic class materials. The list refers to, again, the word trusted keeps getting printed over and over and over again. Trusted news outlets for use in current events assignments, all of which, except for maybe one, overwhelmingly left-leaning. And this is our educational system today. We'll be right back. So many stories out there impacting education. That's why we're so grateful for the contributions that Kelly Solomon from the Cardinal Newman Society makes every week here on the second hour of Catholic Connection. So, Kelly, we've been going back and forth since yesterday and the day before on so many stories that are making headlines. But I wanted to start because I just spent my 2 cents segment this morning talking about Pennsylvania touting media literacy for kids while pushing left-wing sources. The sources that they include in this media literacy kit include the BBC, which right now is embroiled in this huge international bias scandal for major stories. It is just incredible what this network did. In addition to falsely editing a speech of Donald Trump's, their bias regarding the Hamas war, and many other stories. And yet, the state of Pennsylvania, okay, so this came out last year, this list of so-called trusted sources, but they certainly have had ample time to update it or remove both Al Jazeera, the BBC, and even NPR. What's your reaction to the story when you read it? Thanks for joining us.
Well, my first thought, Teresa, was this is right up your alley of exposing the bias in the media. And then the fact that they're promoting this to young students to seek out information. And I think, why not send students to read the best literature that's ever been written, the timeless great books and wide variety of literature that is available to students that they don't need, that we're forming young people and educating them in K-12 education. And what books from the Carnal Newman Society suggested reading list have these children read and been taught and exposed to before they're put into these media sources with big biases and controversies? And how are students going to be able to sort out the truth and find the truth right, when they've never spent time even with the great literature and learning how to analyze a text, how to critical think, how to seek out the truth in these texts?
Well, there's no other reason but to really just kind of brainwash them and to get them to think a particular way, because what they're saying about this media literacy kit is that it gives them resources, and they're supposed to use these so-called trusted resources, Kelly, to do their homework assignments, among other things.
Wow.
I mean, what else can you say except they're trying to brainwash them through this, right?
You know, and that's why the Carnal Newman Society has been raising the alarm about government schools, about secular schools, and how Catholic families need to be really aware of the issues going on in so many of our public schools today. This is just one more example that, you know, they're being pointed to these sources that are going to confuse them, that are not all, always going to present them with the truth. And, you know, this is just another issue like the other issues we've seen in public schools, some public schools that are providing students with books that celebrate gender ideology, that celebrate same-sex marriage, right? These are the problems that young Catholics are going to face in public schools. And so Catholic families really need to know that this is happening and to know that they can seek out other alternatives for their children to be formed, to be educated.
Well, let me read the description that's in this media literacy schools kit. And they describe news organizations, and they say this: use the following list to search for news articles for your current event assignments. These sources are trusted sites organized for each of the topics: world, national, and state, local. World News, Reuters. Reuters has remained true to our trust principles of independence, integrity, and freedom from bias, working relentlessly to bring news from the source of all corners of the globe. British Broadcasting Corporation, the world's largest public service broadcasting network servicing the United Kingdom and the world with top stories. Okay, involved in a major scandal right now. Two of their executives resigned. Al Jazeera. Al Jazeera is in here. The first independent news channel in the Arab world, based in Qatar, focusing on regional and international affairs. The Associated Press, which also has its share of issues, by the way, U.S.-based, founded in 1846, known for fast, accurate, and unbiased news. And The Guardian newspaper, known for investigative journalism focused on U.S. and international news. And then for the national area, they say PBS and NPR. Oh, my goodness. Now, it's interesting, all of these, they don't put a description in about whether they're liberal, but then you come to the Dispatch, which is the lone, more balanced outlet, which tends to be a little bit more conservative, and they put in their conservative lean.
There's always an agenda being pushed here, right? Teresa, how many of these outlets have you exposed media bias in over the years?
Well, all of them. Yeah. It's just so frustrating, though, that they couldn't update this, considering that they came out with this media literacy kit and they've been, you know, making the rounds. The governor and the head of education in Pennsylvania have been making the rounds and just touting these organizations, touting them is so wonderful. So big, big story. Okay, on a positive note, let's talk about the Pope and students and AI, because there is some really good stuff coming out of the Vatican on that, right?
That's right. And, you know, Teresa, that last story, I think, ties into the Pope's emphasis on AI and technology and how it should be, how we should be aware of that it can be used for good or for bad, and and how we need to be very thoughtful with how we're using it. And, you know, in the last story, it's interesting how they're targeting students through what they're reading, through the media they're consuming, because they know it can have such an effect on young people. And so the Pope, in his latest new document on Catholic education that just came out. You know, it's been an exciting couple of weeks in Catholic education with St. John Henry Newman being named Doctor of the Church, patron of Catholic education. Then the Pope releases this new document called Drawing New Maps of Hope. And so we're, you know, going through this document, pulling out different themes. And one of the big themes is the use of AI and technology in education. And that is likely going to be the topic of his next encyclical that will be coming out as well. And so it's interesting to explore and for Catholic families and Catholic educators to read through what the Pope is saying about technology, and then to explore some case studies of what schools have been doing in response to AI and technology already, and you know what they can do going forward.
Yeah, it's so beautiful what's happening, at least in terms of his making, you know, making a real effort to help children understand, young people and kids in high school and college understand the difference between, let's say, AI and reality, right?
Right. Exactly. But, you know, he writes, technologies must serve, not replace the person. They must enrich the learning process, not impoverish relationships and communities. And how much of their communities for young people is now online? I know many college students, they go off and they're already connected with all the new friends they're going to meet in college on social media before they ever step foot on campus. Every student already has an impression and a reputation built just from their social media profile at many colleges today, and how different that is when these communities have gone so digital. The Pope goes on to say, a university and a Catholic school without vision risks soulless efficiency, the standardization of knowledge, which then becomes spiritual impoverishment. I can go on, Teresa. He says, our attitude towards technology can never be hostile, but it requires discernment in planning, evaluation, platforms, data protection, equitable access. In any case, no algorithm can substitute what makes education human. Poetry, irony, love, art, imagination, the joy of discovery, and even learning from mistakes as an opportunity for growth.
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, he's doing a lot with this also with other groups. In addition to the young people, he's really making AI a focus of his pontificate, which I think is so, so crucial and important when you see everything that's going out there. And we can talk more about this when we come back. We are, of course, in our Cardinal Newman Society Tuesday Newman Guide News with Kelly Solomon. More on education, our young people, and what we can do about it when we come back. Welcome back. Catholic Connection, as Kelly and I were saying during the break, we're a source you can trust, certainly, and of course a wonderful Cardinal Newman Society as well. That's why we have Kelly Solomon on with us every week for Newman Guide News. Great story about the Pope and how he's really trying to work with young people and help them understand how to use AI wisely and how to use media wisely in general. There's another story you sent me, Kelly, that was fascinating about how one academy is staying away, having their children stay, the students stay away from social media altogether, correct? Tell us about it.
That's right, Teresa. So as schools respond to, many schools have already been dealing with technology in many different forms. How should teachers use it? How should administrators use it? How should students use it? And, you know, one Catholic school in Texas, Faustina Academy, is a K-12 private independent Catholic school in Irving, Texas. They asked parents to formally commit to a school policy of keeping their kids social media free while enrolled. And what's interesting about this story is it really came apart pretty naturally. It started in 2017 after seeing years of smartphone use and social media apps on children. The principal began asking parents to prohibit social media use among students. She held 2 weeks of mandatory parent meetings for every grade level, discussing the harms of popular smartphone apps that were drawing kids away from reality and exposing them to horrifying content that was right at their fingertips. She even brought in an IT expert to explain to both parents and students that the app and smartphone creators intentionally made the devices addictive. And so this is how it started out. 100% of the parents were willing to verbally commit to keeping their children off social media. But this was kind of raised to the next level in 2022, when parents said, you know, this would actually just be much easier for us if this was an official school policy.
Wow.
And so that's what the principal did. She said, okay, this is now an official policy that we'll go over with newly enrolled families, that there's no social media use by Faustina Academy students.
So it's been going well, because you would think there would be, like, at least among the kids and some parents too, you know, like a huge rebellion to push back against this.
Yes. You know, this is a really faithfully Catholic school. It is one of the schools we recommend in the Newman Guide. As you know, we've been expanding our recommendations of Catholic elementary and secondary schools. So Faustina Academy is one of the Newman Guide recommended schools, and parents are really seeking it out as a faithful Catholic institution where they can partner with other parents and strive among the same goals, right, to help their children know, love, and serve God. And so, you know, they did have a large parent group that was really on board with this, and they said their students didn't receive as much pushback because when all your friends aren't on social media, you don't feel like you're missing out.
Yeah. And I can imagine, I'm sure years will go by and there'll be studies, or the parents and the teachers will probably take note of how different the atmosphere is at home and in school. And I would think that's already happening.
Yes. You know, there was another quote in this article about how much freer and happy their students seemed just because of the detachment from this virtual reality life, and instead really engaging in what's right in front of them. You know, one parent said, kids are catechized on the playground. Their peers and what their peers' families are doing affects them, regardless of what their teachers say.
Wow. That's awesome. Now, I wonder, do you think something like that would catch on? Are there other schools, Catholic schools, doing that you know of, Kelly?
Yes. You know, I think this is a big topic among families right now. I see this actually at my local Catholic school that my children attend, and I can see that we're just at the beginning stages of where this Faustina Academy was years ago, because a group of parents is starting to talk. And the first step was they sent out literature, right, to all the families about things to be aware of on personal smartphones and social media sites, about pornography addictions and addictions to the phone, and dangerous sites and things that students can come across. So they're starting to educate parents about these things. And I can see this quickly moving to the next step of getting some parent meetings going and more parent formation on these topics. And again, recognizing that parents are the primary educators of their children, that we need to be aware of what we're allowing our children to be exposed through technology. How can we use technology for good? How can we do you know, what the Pope was saying in his new document on Catholic education about using it for its good and not letting students just live in a virtual reality where they have no connection to our real life here on earth and our dignity and image in the image of God.
Yeah, I wonder, is there any pushback? Because some parents know, if you look at this happening in other schools, in secular school districts, for example, or public school districts, they say, well, I want to be able to reach my student, my son or daughter, in case of an emergency. But at the same time, if there's an emergency, you don't want the kids to, you know, be on the phone. You want them to be paying attention to what the school is trying to get them to do in terms of their safety.
Right, exactly. And I think schools have so many processes set up for things like that. I mean, many schools already do not let their students have access to their phones, at least during the day while they're at school. And, you know, some schools will have students check in their phone when they first come in, and they have to get it out from the office at the end of the day. Then they're allowed to turn it on and contact their parents and whatnot. So this is, you know, an issue that's constantly changing. There's new things being built in AI and technology all the time. And I think as Catholics, we really need to lead on this issue. And I think our Catholic schools can set an example with how this is handled and then show the kind of lives that students are able to build because we don't have an addiction to technology. You know, it's not just taking something away. It's filling it with joyful, wholesome, good activities that are community building, that give students those relationships to build and to make good friendships.
This is a pretty incredible report on Catholic News Agency that you're quoting, Kelly, and I would encourage parents to look it up online. I just want to read a little bit more from it. The expert, and this is back in 2022, as you mentioned, when this person first came in and talked to the parents about social media and cell phones, The expert told parents kids could easily access content so harmful it was far beyond what anyone could even imagine. Parents were amazed at what they learned and 100% were willing to verbally commit to keeping their children off social media. She said it was necessary that every parent get on board, and you mentioned this earlier, in order to address a collective action problem, the fear of missing out, FOMO, that will be present among the students if every family did not have the same policy at home. And then in 2022, as you mentioned earlier, the official policy became official policy at the school. This is incredible, and this is super, super important, again, for people to join together. There is safety, I think, in numbers, and to have that backing of other parents, that's got to be a real boost, I think, for moms and dads.
Exactly. I mean, as moms and dads, wow, I want other parents to be supporting the same kind of mission we're trying to provide for our kids. And, you know, Teresa, what I'm seeing at a lot of other public schools, when they find students having issues with smartphones and technology, addictions to pornography, or another parent in this article even mentioned how at a previous school, an eighth grade girl became involved with a 45-year-old man who she thought was a teenage boy through social media. And rather than recognizing the dangers and changing their policies, the school hushed it up. I think that this is a very hushed up topic in education overall today. And again, as Catholics, we really shouldn't be quiet about it. We should be proactively addressing this because of the whole formation we're trying to provide students can be very undermined by things like social media use and addiction to smartphones.
Yeah, it's really a great idea. Okay, one more story we have time for. Oh my goodness, the president of Georgetown. Fill us in on this. Oops, Kelly, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead.
Okay, so this one, apparently the new president of Georgetown University wrote in an article several years ago, and I hope that he has changed his mind, that he will be public about his support of church teaching now. But as far as we're aware, no other indication has been made that he said he opposes church teaching on homosexuality. So this is obviously a big scandal. This is the kinds of issues the Cardinal Newman Society has been reporting on, especially in Catholic higher education for 30 years, that this is not what the church expects of Catholic education and its leaders, that our leaders should be pledging fidelity to the church, publicly supporting church teaching, and setting that example for the thousands of students who attend that Catholic college.
But what do you do with this? I mean, it's just, it's so alarming in terms of also pushing back. He pushed back against Roe v. Wade, the reversal of Roe v. Wade, and he's the head of a Catholic university. It's just so frustrating to see this kind of thing. Now, I was glad to see that your own, of course, president, Patrick Riley, spoke out about this.
Yes, he did. You know, Patrick has been an outspoken advocate for faithful Catholic education for a long time. He wants families to be aware of these issues. He wants them to know where they should send their children, which institutions they should financially support, that they should make their friends aware of these things, that you have to be discerning about your education you're choosing for your kids and for your grandkids and for even telling your friends about the issues that are going on in higher education at many secular universities. Unfortunately, at many Catholic colleges. And so seek out a Newman Guide college. That's what, you know, I would say, Teresa.
No, I totally agree. And if you find this out and your kids are going to this school and they come home and they've lost their Catholic faith, and you know what? Something's got to change. I'm sorry. So I love what Patrick said. He didn't mince any words. Let me share his quotes. Georgetown was dangerous for Catholic families even before this. Patrick Riley, president of the Carmel Newman Society, told LifeSite News via email. What can be expected from a Catholic university president who publicly rejects Catholic teaching on sexuality? This is part of the truth that is foundational to Catholic education. Every Catholic educator should vigorously oppose what this man embraced 11 years ago, and while I hope he has since returned to Christ, I can't imagine trusting him as a leader of Catholic education, Riley said. Jesus told Peter to feed his sheep, but Georgetown is leading lambs to the slaughter. Wow. Good for him. Good for Patrick for being so strong.
Amen. Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, again, it's just, it's like, where are these people coming from? Why do they want to be at a Catholic, so-called Catholic university, if they feel this way? Why are they even Catholic? If you don't agree with church teaching, why are you Catholic? Why?
Right. And that Catholic colleges should be actually educating students on these issues, forming them in truth and in faith and reason, and giving them the reasons why the church teaches what she teaches. Right.
Right.
Yes. So I pray for the students there. I pray they can come across the Newman Guide. Many Newman Guide colleges accept transfer students. You know, don't spend your time and your money in a place that's not going to build you up in your faith, where you're not right. going to be a stronger Catholic at the end of your 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Because what really matters, your degree or your soul? Your soul is a lot more important, right?
Right.
Yeah. Kelly, great stuff. I mean, there's other stories that we could look at, but I think we covered quite a bit in today's two segments. And I'm so excited about, of course, St. John Henry Newman becoming a doctor of the church. I haven't talked to Patrick as I was taping last week. Did he have a great time in Rome?
He had a wonderful time in Rome. He was at the Jubilee Gathering for Educators. He was at the Mass, naming Cardinal Newman a doctor of the church. He was even able to go over to one of our Newman Guide recommended colleges, Catholic Institute of Technology, provisionally recommending the Newman Guide, and give a mm-hmm. lecture there on St. John Henry Newman. And I think he really sees it as part of the vision for Cardinal Newman Society to even more so educate people about St. John Henry Newman, his vision for education, which is distorted in a lot of places, that Newman really argued for authentically Catholic education that would reintegrate everything within a student.
Well, great news, of course, about John Henry Newman becoming a doctor of the church, and we so appreciate all your great updates, Kelly, which is why we have you on every week. CardinalNewmanSociety.org for more information. We'll be right back. Thanks so much for tuning in to a Tuesday morning edition, the second hour of CC with TT on EWTN's Radio Extra, EWTN.com. And you can do a search on the website to share this second hour with folks as well. Just do EWTN Radio Extra. It'll pop up. There'll be a link to the app, and you can download it on your laptop, on your phone, any device you like. And you can listen to us for 2 hours a day. First, of course, well, if you stay on the app, you can listen on the radio and just go through the whole program. So it makes it very, very easy. All right, coming up tomorrow, it is a Wednesday, which means we check back in with Joan Lewis. Very excited, of course, to always check in with Joan. She'll have the papal audience message, and she'll have an update on the Holy Father's schedule. Today, I was noticing that there's a brand new documentary that's been done on the Holy Father, Leo from Chicago. Pretty cool. It was put together by the Vatican Bureau, and it has some great shots and B-roll of the Windy City, of course, with some amazing pictures of the Holy Father before he was a priest, and of course, as he began his priestly ministry in the city of Chicago. So it looks like a really interesting documentary. I'm sure Joan will be up to date on that. And then we're also going to get an update on the beautiful film about St. Maximian Kolbe. It's entitled Triumph of the Heart, and it was done by our friend Marcellino D'Ambrosio's son, Anthony D'Ambrosio. And my understanding is that the film has been very, very well received. But this would be something that will be a great resource to bring to your parish, to bring to your Bible study, because it's a very powerful film. Have a great Tuesday. We'll talk to you tomorrow on a Wednesday. Ciao, ciao.